Professor Amsdorf, you're here for a symposium that has just concluded at Boston University. And the subject of that symposium was how differently the climate debate is perceived on both sides of the Atlantic. So I would like you to perhaps give us a glimpse what it's like on the other side of the Atlantic, how that debate looks from your perspective.
Well, I think the key difference that we see in the United States compared to pretty well all the rest of the world is how polarized this debate is in the United States, where even basic questions of science seem to be divided along party lines. But, you know, it's almost as if there was a Republican physics and Democrat physics, which obviously does make no sense. In Europe, we have a much less polarized situation. For example, in Germany, where I come from, all the parties in parliament are in complete agreement that this is an urgent issue to tackle climate change. And I think that is a situation that you will find in most countries of the world. The real debates there are how best to deal with it. How do we get down the emissions quickly enough? What are the key measures to achieve that, and so on? And I think that's really where the political debate should be, rather than debating basic facts of science.
It's actually quite surprising because that is a Christian democratic conservative government that we're talking about here in Germany.
Well, I don't find that surprising. I find the United States situation very surprising because, of course, why would conservatives not be in favor of maintaining the long-term stability of the Earth climate and the health of the ecosystems and stability for human development? Because obviously what climate change is doing most is it is actually risking people's livelihoods, people's security. And I see no link with being conservative or so and one denying that there is a problem. That just doesn't make sense to me.
So what then is driving public opinion? Is it political parties? Is it governments? Is it industry lobbies?
Well, of course, you'd have to ask that question to a social scientist. I'm a natural scientist. I don't really study these issues, but surely all of these factors play some role.
From what I've learned, it is actually in a large way driven by government in Europe. Is that a correct perception?
I don't think so. I think that, of course, the reason why governments take this seriously is that there is a big groundswell of support in the population that we should be doing something to halt global warming. And the fact that this groundswell is there, of course, that's something that hasn't just come out of nothing. It's developed over decades. And, of course, civil society, I think, has played a major role there.
I attended a public talk by climatologist Stephen Schneider. He pointed out that everyone's home has fire insurance, typically, yet only a very small percentage of people actually ever have a fire at their home. So we think it's an insurance issue to guard against potentially horrific outcomes. I'm wondering, though, is that still a good analogy, because that's how he uses it, for climate change and its potential impacts for humanity?
Well, actually, I don't think so, because with an insurance, you try to insure yourself against a rare event where you don't really expect this to happen to you, but you kind of share out the risk amongst millions of people so that the few that this happens to will be covered by everyone else in a kind of solidarity. With the climate change problem, we have a completely different situation because, first of all, negative impacts are virtually certain. You know, it's not like one in a 10,000 chance that your house burns down, but it's like 95% or 99% probability for extreme events to increase. They already are increasing, for sea level rise, which is already rising, of course, as the data show, to take on very dangerous proportions and so on. So I think the insurance analogy is not quite right. And it's also not about, in this case, spreading the risk among many people so that everybody just has to pay a small fee, because the risk really, climate change will really affect every one of us on this planet, some more, some less, but I think everybody will be affected.
Yeah, sometimes people think, oh, maybe it's just those small island states that will unfortunately have to find higher ground. But we're also talking about glaciers that feed the Himalayan rivers, the Yangtze and the Mekong and so on. Those do not just affect a few hundred thousand people. They affect hundreds of millions of people.
Well, as I said, most people will be affected one way or another, for example, by extreme events. Just think about what happened this summer. We had large parts of central Russia under an unprecedented heat wave, heat unprecedented in at least a millennium. We had Pakistan suffering from unprecedented flooding, which followed unprecedented rainfall. And, of course, you can't attribute an individual extreme event to global warming, but we can say that the number of these extreme events has increased several fold, so that probably more than half of these unprecedented extremes that we have recently witnessed would not have occurred without global warming.
I've seen you've been quite outspoken in your critique of some of the so-called climate skeptics, and there's one person especially who stands out, Bjørn Lomborg from Denmark, teaches at a business school, but he dishes out lots of data.
Well, Lomborg writes many columns that get printed around the world, and he wrote one that I happened to see in The Guardian, which had the nice title, Let the Data Speak for Themselves, where he was saying that scientists are telling you that sea level is rising, but that's not true. Sea level has actually fallen in the past 2 years, and should we not be told that things are much better than expected? And since I work on sea level rise, I got quite angry with that, because it's obviously a kind of way to fool people, because any geophysical time series like sea level has wiggles going up and down, and you can always pick a short bit out of a longer time series, like in this case 2 years, as Lomborg had done, where the trend will be falling instead of rising as it is in the somewhat longer term. And by the time Lomborg published this commentary, sea level already had risen again to unprecedented levels. So if you were just an ordinary layperson hearing that, you might think, oh yeah, maybe those climate scientists are really exaggerating things and sea level is actually dropping, so it can't be so bad, which is, of course, not the truth of the matter.
But that is a rather worrying aspect, because you can show that there's actual manipulation. The statement had no basis, and the only reason to make it would have been to mislead people. Could you talk a little bit about the concerted effort to push the debate in a non-scientific direction?
Well, there's both the demand side and the supply side, so to speak. The reason why Lomborg is very successful with what he writes is that there is a demand for this. There's enough people who want to read this kind of thing, and they prefer the reassuring fairy tales to the discomforting truth, so they buy these books. Then, of course, there is also a kind of massive supply side, in the sense that there are lobby organizations that are actively pushing disinformation because they have a political agenda and they try to deliberately confuse the public about the science of climate change.
So in your opinion, what should be the role of a climate scientist under these circumstances of a concerted effort to mislead?
Well, first and foremost, the role of a climate scientist is, of course, to do the science, do the research, and that is what I'm mostly doing, of course. But I think we also have a duty to explain our findings and the state of the science to the general public. It's, of course, up to everybody whether they take that on board, want to read it, or whether they prefer to read the stuff that Lomborg writes. You know, that's not my problem, but I think my responsibility is to make the good scientific information available for those people who care about it.
We've mentioned that Europe has very different policies and public perceptions about the climate debate. However, Europe is not a monolithic bloc.
Well, that's true that Europe has a problem. It's 27 member states that, of course, have diverse interests. We have heavily coal-dependent states like Poland. We have some countries with right-wing governments like Berlusconi in Italy. We clearly have some leaders in the fight to stop global warming, including Denmark, Britain, Germany, for example. And the European Commission, which is like the government of Europe, as far as Europe has a government, is actually also very proactive in taking its member states to task when it comes to actually implementing the emissions reduction measures that are needed. And Europe is actually over-fulfilling its Kyoto commitments, for example. In a way, it's surprising, but it has worked to get these very diverse interests combined into a reasonably effective policy. I mean, for example, we have an emissions trading system, a cap-and-trade system in Europe that's been going for a number of years. It's had its teething problems, but it's getting into good shape now. And so, surprisingly, despite all those countries with their different interests, it is possible to work together and to really make a difference and reduce emissions. I mean, just to give you one number, since 1990, the European Union has reduced the carbon dioxide emissions by 7% while growing its economy by 45%.
Isn't the reason for Europe's success in that area also because it has taken this challenge as an opportunity, as an export market for goods that conform to a lower carbon economy?
Well, I think anybody who doesn't realize that clean energy is the big growth market of the 21st century hasn't really understood very much. And that is, of course, one of the driving forces as well, that there are many opportunities in this, also employment opportunities, and it has become a major export earner. And those who are kind of the first, the technology leaders in this field, will definitely benefit.
Professor Amsdorf, I'd like to thank you for this interview. And it's great that you've made the trip over the Atlantic. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.